Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Coming up, Spider Caldwell on the Penn State uniforms this weekend. Paul Posluszny, Jacksonville Jaguars, final half hour. Tomorrow, Lou Prado, my brother, and also Brad Nessler from CBS on Tuesday. We have a lot going on. First, our play-by-play call of the day. The Cubs clinch the National League Central. Pat Hughes on WSCR.
Here is Randall Grichuk. Grichuk with a single and three tries. Right-handed batter. Bill Madden always puts the word breathe on the bottom of the scoreboard when you get into the postseason. Breathe. Here's the pitch. Fly ball to deep center field. Back goes Martin. At the wall. He's there. He's got it. And the Cubs win the Central Division. The Cubs come out of the third base dugout. They start to celebrate on the mound and near the mound. All 25 guys jumping up and down. The Cubs have defended their world title with their second consecutive Central Division title.
So that gets them into the playoffs. They're there, so they'll be in. They'll get a chance to defend their title, and they win the Central Division. All right. Generations of Greatness. That's what they're calling it. That's what the uniform is going to be called. And a lot of input from former equipment manager Spider Caldwell. Spider, welcome back. It's always great to hear you.
It's great, buddy. It's been a fun week. It really has. And I'm just reminiscing a lot, and that's kind of what this weekend I think was all about. Bring back some memories, and I just can't wait till the fans kind of see us running out of the tunnel. And I think there's going to be everybody relates. A lot of times people relate back to the '60s and '70s, and this is going to give you a feel for that. I think when you see the team and. It's got to be a lot of fun.
It's interesting because it also means a lot of work for the equipment staff. Now, they practice, they have practice helmets and they have game helmets. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. So they've already changed out the face masks on the game helmets. They don't have to do on the practice helmets, obviously. But one thing Correct. They do have to do is they have to put the decals, the numerical decals, on each side of the helmets. When you had to do that in 2012 when they put Michael Motti's 42 on one side of the helmet, how long did that take you?
Well, it's funny because that decision was made like a Tuesday after practice. The team captains went to Coach O'Brien and asked him if we could do something like that for honor Mike and his injury. And Coach thought it was a great idea and wanted to do something. So he came to me. Well, obviously you can't get the numbers in 2 days to get those numbers. I actually went to our sign shop on campus and they were able to make the 42s for me, but they only made so many. And the material they used was very thin. So I was so worried about you put one on the helmet, and if it was crooked, you try to peel it off, it would rip. And we didn't have that many to waste. So I said, I can't have my students do this. And I was just worried about them, messing them up. So I decided to do it myself. So I spent 5 hours Friday night before that game, the Wisconsin game, putting those on. So, and it's only on one side. So obviously, these guys are putting them on two sides. But it takes a lot of time. It really does.
But what was his reaction when he walked in?
Well, when Mike walked in, it was a special moment. They had him come off the team bus first, and Zordich had his arm around him, and they brought him in, and I had all the helmets sitting on the benches with the 42, being out, and he walked in, and Mike. He glanced and he saw, you could just see it was really a neat shot of the helmets all down along the bench with 42s, out front. And he dropped his head and he literally sprinted. Now, remember, Zordich had his arm around him. He literally breaks off from Zordich and sprints to the shower. And basically, he was in there tearing up and he couldn't believe it. And so he comes back out and after he got his composure and he's walking over and he's looking at the helmets, and the players are coming in now, giving him five, giving him hugs. So he walks over towards the equipment room, and I looked at him. I said, "Hey, you better appreciate this, you son of a gun. I spent 5 hours here last night putting him on." So he laughed, gave me a big hug, and it was a special moment for him. And that just tells you the kind of character that he was and the kind of leader he was for the team to want to do that and for us to do. I mean, in our history, we've never done anything like that pretty much. And we honored a player back in 1985,
yes.
And one of our walk-on players that we had a player that was killed here. Over Easter break.
Gene Lyons,
correct.
Yeah,
and we put an 85 on the back of our helmets, and it was 1985, actually, when that happened. So, and we honored him that year. So,
the fans get, of course, a little squirrely about a couple things. Okay. You're going to play a night game at Kinnick Stadium.
Hey, oh, yeah.
You're playing 11 a.m. at Northwestern. Like,
oh, okay. Another killer. That's it. Yeah.
I was like, okay. Now it's they're wearing white shoes.
If you're
going to ask the players what feature of the uniform they love the most, it is by a wide margin the white shoes. What is the story behind the fact that in that Sugar Bowl game they wore, not everybody, see, this is, again, there's a lot of mythology that goes on here. Not everybody wore them, but why did the majority of the players wear white shoes in that game?
Well, I'm actually not sure exactly the decision to go to why they were white, but I do know, we always were playing on AstroTurf, and AstroTurf back then was awful. I mean, it was like playing on your indoor-outdoor carpeting on your grandmother's back porch. And it was, hard, whatnot. And I know Adidas, being the actual championship game, they gave us free shoes to use to play in that game, and they were white. And again, I'm not sure.
I think it's just because that's what they sent.
And you're probably right. And I know they... And some guys, I don't think they felt right in them, or they didn't feel, they were brand new. So some guys wore the black because of, the feel for, just having, some guys were real funny about their shoe. They like them broke in. They
right.
almost have fallen off themselves. So again, and majority of the starters did have the white ones, and I know they wore them, whatnot, but, for that indoor.
I think we lost Spider there for a second. So what we'll do is we'll call him back and get him back on the line quickly here. We'll take care of that in a moment. What happened though is that, again, not every player wore them in the game. That's, again, part of the mythology of sports, is they think every Penn State player wore white shoes in that game. Did not, but the vast majority did. And they were looking for a shoe from Adidas to play on turf. It was as simple as that. They actually were more like sneakers basketball shoes, weren't they, Spider?
Yeah, they were. They were actually like a flat-bottom basketball sneaker, correct.
Yeah, so
yep.
So they wear that, but after the game, Joe made a vow.
He did. Joe actually made a vow. He said, as long as I'm here, we'll never wear black shoes again, or never wear white shoes again. So, because Joe was very superstitious. I mean, if you'd ask Joe, are you superstitious, he'd say no.
No.
But the pant legs rolled up and whatnot. So he was very superstitious, and he used to always like to have always used to give him two hot dogs with mustard before every away mm-hmm. game, but he only ever eat one. Right. So because it was superstitious.
Right. Yeah, I know. You and I know that. we do know.
Yes, we do.
What part of the uniform that is subtle that maybe people don't notice that really intrigued you when it was put forward?
Well, a couple of subtle things. I mean, I know, you won't really see it from the distance and whatnot, but that, the lion in the middle, where we are right now, we have the actual lion head on the V of our collar. They now have they have the lion shrine, in honor of the 1940 team that donated the lion shrine,
right.
The class of Ford in 1940 that donated the Lion Shrine. So the Lion Shrine is in the middle there on the B, you'll notice in the white trim on the sleeve. Now they did not put the white trim on the collar, and I think it was more of a, we still want to be retro. We want to go with, the combination of the retro look. So they just did kind of half the trim, you know. So instead of putting the trim on the sleeve and collar, they just put it on the sleeve. But again, we had that on our sleeve as well from probably I think it was 1957 to, mid-1960s. 1966, I think we had the small on the sleeve as well. But it's funny, some of these changes happen through the years. It kind of is, I don't say accidents, but sometimes they're, you can blame two or three of them on the equipment managers. I mean, they just kind of happen. It's not like there's this big meeting of the president and the AD and all that stuff decide. Sometimes they just kind of happen. Like, we wanted to pink and black. And we, right. One of the main reasons for pink and black was that the uniform faded. The dyes ran, right. And the black pants became a light, almost a navy, and the pink ran out of the white jersey, and the jersey became white. So the student body changed, decided they liked the look of it and went with the blue white. So you can blame that on the equipment manager's fault. Right. And also the blue face mask. I mean, you can probably blame that on myself, on me. I actually, we had gray face masks up till 1987. And in 1986 and 85, the face mask in that era, during the Michael Singletary days, when the Chicago Bears and the 85 Bears, they had these big fat face masks. The gray ones were a charcoal gray. They were real, almost black. Mm-hmm. So in 87, they went to the thin wire face mask for the first time.
Yeah.
Well, the thin wire face mask in gray was very light. It was almost a white. And you'll notice that the face masks are very light, because that's what they still are, kind of a lighter gray. So anyway, I was assistant at the time. I had mentioned to Tim Shope, the head equipment manager, that, boy, Shope, we're so used to these thick, heavy, dark face masks. Why don't we just go to navy? And he said, yeah, that might look better. So we'll match the stripe. So we put navy on, never ask anybody. We just phased it in. So sometimes, so hopefully we'll get fired for that. But that's kind of how that happened at this transition. So that's sometimes how it happens. It's funny.
Now, this isn't your area, but at the same time, it's also part of the era, going to the Argyle end zone, which you've had a good look at it from your office.
Yeah, they didn't have the blue diamonds on yet. They did had the white ones there earlier in the week, and they just put the blue ones on just now. It's really neat. It's very sharp, and it's going to be. It gives you goosebumps, kind of thinking of the late '60s, early '70s. You see the guys running out of the tunnel. When I first put the uniform together, back in, because actually Coach O'Brien had looked at doing something like this as well, and we had suggested it, but he just kind of backed off from it. And Coach Franklin really took it to the next level, and I showed him the uniform as soon as he got here, and he was very, he thought it'd be neat, but he didn't want to do it right away either, so he waited for a couple more years, obviously, and we're doing it now. But when you put the uniform together, when I showed him for the first time, you just feel like you're seeing, it just reminds you of Franco Harris, and Cappy, it gives you that retro feel. And, when they run out of the tunnel with that end zone, it's going to be a neat, it's really going to be a neat look.
Is there anything in retrospect, you're done, that you thought of later and said, probably could have included that too?
Yeah, I thought the white the white collar initially. Okay. I mean, I know it was one of the things I thought would have been, that we missed, because that was from 1980.
Yeah, it was
till 2011. And see, we took the trim off in 2011 because that was our 2011 was our 125th anniversary of Penn State football.
Right.
So we had decided, as the marketing people had decided, and Guido had decided, let's take that off. And that's when we changed the end zone to the block Penn State,
right?
To go more retro. So that pretty much was just for that year. Now technically, we probably could have went back to the white and trims, but we just stayed away with it, and stayed with what we had. So it's funny. And then the very next year, we had the Big Ten logo was mandated by Big Ten to put on.
Right.
Excuse me. So we put that on. The year after that, we decided, well, Big Ten's branding themselves, let's brand ourselves and put the line head in the middle on ours. So we put the small line head on the V at the end of the collar. So just, you can just see how kind of things morphed the way they do, over the years.
Have you been surprised over the years, Spider, with how particular the fans are about the uniform?
Oh, it's that's the thing. When Coach O'Brien first came in, and he was wanting, hey, he wanted to maybe to bling it up a little bit too. And you know, he was looking to throw the guys a bone because of what happened. And yeah. You know, he was just trying to make it as user friendly as he could here. And I'm like, well, you know, he was taking to do some stuff, and you know, he even had me make up a blue helmet with a white face mask, and I'm like, well, and as soon as you saw it, you're like, oh my, that's no way, that didn't even look like Penn State. So it was. It didn't take him long to realize, you know, boy, I said, Coach, you got to take baby steps here with the uniform. It is very sacred to a lot of people, and it's something that's really looked upon as it's very iconic, and it's us. I mean, and I think I always said something that I remember being behind Coach Paterno one time when a reporter asked him, when Oregon was doing all their stuff and Maryland was doing their crazy stuff, a reporter said, Coach, why don't you guys get into that here at Penn State? And he says, you noticed, didn't you? Yeah. You noticed our uniforms. Why do we need to? That's who we are. That's our brand. So, and it is. It's kind of, it's one of them. I think we're one of a few teams that are, just historically iconic in the country. And you recognize who it is when you turn the TV on right away,
Well, it's interesting. Any little change over the years. I remember in 1980 when they put the white around the home and the blue around the road uniforms. What have they done?
Yes.
When Nike, because Nike's the supplier of all this, put the swoosh on. It is their stuff,
And it's funny. Nike was smart because their marketing people, jerseys always had logos on them. They're just were down where you would tuck them in.
Right.
Russell, Champion, all them. Well, Nike was just smart and moved it up to where you could see it more visible. And I remember Keith Jackson, Keith Jackson, the famous announcer. Did a lot of the Midwest games. Keith Jackson, the minute that was put on in 1993 for the first time, the swoosh, I remember Keith saying, boy, who'd ever dream? They were talking about corporate sponsorships and how it's going with the bowl games. And I remember Keith Jackson then said, boy, talking about sponsorship and stuff, who'd ever dream you'd see that? He called it the check instead of the swoosh. Yep. Who'd ever dream you'd see the check on a Penn State uniform? That's like putting a mustache on the Mona Lisa.
Well, interesting about that is that Joe, they redid his contract with Nike, mm-hmm. he wanted to help out as many people as possible. And at the time, the club hockey team, it was mm-hmm. a club hockey team. So yeah, Joe, in the contract, got them club hockey, ice hockey uniforms from Nike.
That's true.
Other teams in the clubs, Arizona State, people like that, were thoroughly jealous because Penn State's going around with these Nike jerseys, and they're like, oh, they're picking up stuff that from the scrap heap down at the consignment shop.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. it's funny too. Just think back to the trim on the sleeve and the collar. That's another technically equipment manager mistake or whatever you want to say. But back in 1980,
you're admitting a lot of mistakes here today.
I know. Well, we'll call it an accident. Okay. Yeah. In 1980, we went to Russell jerseys, and they wanted to. Russell was having trouble matching the blue. The on the collar and the blue the mesh body of the jersey were two different blues, and they couldn't get it to match. So they just asked, hey, could we go ahead and just do the opposite? Can we make that white, and then on the blue ones we'll make it, or the white ones we'll make it blue? Right. We're having trouble matching the material. So we just, Tim Schopp, the head of guy, equipment manager at the time, just said, yeah, go ahead, that should be fine. When he gets the jerseys in, he's like, oh no, it really changes the look of the jersey. I'm dead. I'm going to be. So he goes to Joe, Nike, Russell screwed up and sent these with the trim. So Russell screwed up. So yeah. Russell screwed up and sent us with the trim. They put white on the blue jersey. So Joe looks at it and says, and it was only about a quarter inch wide. He said, it's not that bad. The players have been wanting me to bling it up a little bit anyway and make the jersey fancier. So we'll leave it. And we're going to surprise them, and we'll tell them that the first game we'll have an unveiling, and we'll show them that. So sure enough, the players are rumored going around, the jerseys are changed. They have different jerseys. They're all fired up. They're all excited, So, and I forget the first home game that year. So they have it all set up, the jersey hanging in the locker.
Colgate or something like that.
That's it. Yeah. So the players walk in the locker room. They're all excited, thinking they're going to see their jersey. Here's this little wee skinny quarter inch white trim on the sleeve and on this car. And they're like, that's it?
How dare it?
And they were just, you never noticed it because back then in those days, the guys took their arms and they tied them up, and they put tape on their guns, you know, show their guns. So they would roll them up, and you'd never see them. And then the neck rolls back then, if you remember, the neck rolls were like big giant horse collars.
I know.
So you never saw that little skinny white trim on those jerseys. You probably didn't notice it for 4 or 5 years that we actually had white trim on a jersey. So it just kind of morphed them. And then as the jersey changed in companies, you know, after Russell, we were champion. After that, we went to Nike. The construction of the jersey changed with the trims, and they became wider just by construction. So, again, that made it more visible then, back when, you know, when you started noticing the trim. But anyway. Yeah. So,
well, Joe used to hold up the bowl patch. Now, you have to wear the bowl patch now. You have
yes,
choice.
You do. Yes.
You're mandated to wear it. But he'd hold up and says, do you want this defacing our uniform? And the whole team would vote, no.
Yeah, of course. Right. Yeah, we had never – it was the first game was 1999, the Alamo Bowl. Yep. We played A&M. We had it was the first mandated time when we had to – they put a fine actually in your contract if you do not wear the because of corporate sponsorship thing. So,
well, we could go on for hours, but I also know you're busy, and there's something on the. I can hear Bob White lurking in the background, getting ready to scream at you at the top of his lungs to get back to work. So I'll let you get back to work.
Yeah, well, it's great talking to you, Steve. And again, I hope everybody enjoys the weekend. And it's going to be supposed to be a nice day, and it's going to be a fun day when you watch those guys run out of the tunnel. It's going to bring back some good memories.
Always a pleasure hearing your voice at the other end. Thanks, Spider.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it, Steve. Have a good one, man.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Spider Caldwell. Coming up, Paul Posluszny. Bottom of the hour news next on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC Way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC Way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC Way. The SMC Way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to have you with us. We had another during the break incident. The suit sent me a text with his best field goal calls. Did you know that?
Ooh.
Now, you know me pretty well.
Sure.
What do you think I did with it?
You probably took, didn't even take you 2 or 3 seconds to look at it and then delete.
With that, we bring in Paul Posluszny of the Jacksonville Jaguars. Paul, welcome. It is always great to hear you on the other end, my friend.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
All right. I want to ask you, because Jacksonville's had to do the London thing a lot over time. How tough is that on the return week for any team that has to play?
It's challenging. It's definitely, I mean, especially when you consider, you know, London is a home game. It's considered a home game for the Jaguars. So it can be a challenge to come back from an international flight and then be ready to reload on Monday afternoon and start preparing for another team. But going into the season, we knew that was going to be the situation for us, so we need to be able to figure out a way to handle it.
Right, and over the years, how have you handled it? Because, you know, we're always talking about recovery. Penn State just went through a game where the offense ran 99 plays on a 92-degree night, so people have talked about recovery. How do you recover from that?
What Penn State just went through seems like a lot more difficult than what we went through. I mean, the thing is just getting back to East Coast time, catching up on sleep, understanding the importance of rest, hydration, proper nutrition, doing all that thing, all those things, and trying to maximize all of those things to the best of our ability. So when it's time to practice, starting again on Wednesday, we're fully prepared and ready to go.
Yeah. What's for you? You go through a really fabulous Penn State career here. When you got to the pros, how much of it is a game and how much of it is a business?
It is very much a business. You learn that very, very quickly. I think the thing is, when you play in college, you're obviously playing for your teammates, for your school. We almost felt like we were playing for, you know, going to a major school like Penn State, you feel like you're playing for the entire state of Pennsylvania. And then in the National Football League, things can change quickly. And you understand that it is absolutely, it's an occupation. And there's obviously still a love for the game. I mean, don't love playing on Sundays. But the challenges of guys coming and going, coaches coming and going, it ends up being just a different atmosphere in the NFL.
I remember when you made the move here from outside linebacker to inside linebacker, and you and I had talked about it, whether it was a quarterback club or a pregame show or something like that, and you talked about how different the pattern was. I think you're doing a little bit more outside linebacker now after all those years inside. How different has that been?
That was a challenge for me in the beginning. Now we've gone back. So I'm back to playing middle linebacker now. Okay. At the beginning of the season, throughout the preseason, I was playing and taking reps at outside linebacker as well as middle linebacker, just to get a feel for how we would look as a defense and how we could operate. And at the end of the day, you know, once it was time to prepare for week one, the team decided to put me back in middle linebacker. So I'm back at home right now.
And so it must feel a lot more comfortable. Also, the bottom line is you're coming off a nice 44-7 win over Baltimore. How much better is your team now?
We've definitely made strides, especially compared to how we've played in the past. But you know how it is in the NFL. It's still very early in the season, and we still feel like we have a lot of work to do to play at a high level consistently. But we're definitely heading in the right direction. We have great leadership with our head coach, Doug Marrone, and we're just following his lead. We feel like as long as we continue to put in a lot of hard work, energy, and effort, that we have an opportunity to compete.
But losing Allen Robinson, another former Penn Stater, who did not obviously wasn't here when you were here, but how tough's that been to overcome because he was so dependable and a Pro Bowler?
You feel awful for him, obviously, because, you know, he's such a great guy and he's an enormous asset to this team. So to have him go down in week one, tough loss. You can't replace a guy like that. You know what I mean? He's like you said, Pro Bowl receiver, stud athlete, great guy to have on our team. So it's the thing is, the receiver core has done a great job of taking new roles, you know, to try to fill his spot with a talented guy like Allen Robinson. I mean, you can't say you plug somebody else in to replace him. It's definitely a group effort.
All right, you have to obviously every week study tendencies of quarterbacks and so forth because you've always played the pass well. When you were here at Penn State, Jack Ham talked all the time about how well you play the pass. So when you look at a guy like Blake Bortles, you know, how tough is a transition for any quarterback to the speed of this league, because you know it firsthand?
I think it can be very difficult for a lot of guys, just because for quarterbacks throwing, the window of opportunity versus, you know, who's open and who's not closes so quickly in the NFL compared to college. I mean, so that can be a big challenge. And the fact that defenses can be a little bit different. Obviously, everybody on the field is an outstanding athlete in the NFL. So the overall physical and mental speed of the game changes. So it's obviously a challenge, you know, for any young quarterback to come in and try to compete at a high level early.
Obviously, you know, everyone knows that you'll be asked at some point about the national anthem. So along the way, I'm going to take it from a different point of view. What kind of talks have there been in the locker room about this, team meetings about that, and how interesting has the conversation been about it?
It's been very interesting and very positive with our group in Jacksonville. Because we have a lot of guys that obviously feel strongly about it, and it's gotten to the point now where guys are no longer interested in making a demonstration on Sunday. It's, hey, what can we really do in the local community in Jacksonville or our local hometowns to make a change. Do you know what I mean? Because there obviously are issues that guys are very interested in helping out and making a difference. And so the conversation has moved on to that, which is awesome, because that will bring about real positive change. If we can actually get out and do things, whether it's go to the Boys and Girls Club of Jacksonville or work with our local police department, anything to improve community relations, or the issues of inequality that guys are discussing, if we can physically do that, that's the ultimate goal.
Paul, I watched Doug Baldwin. He was on last night with Michael Bennett on Anderson Cooper's show on CNN, and he talked very eloquently about, look, you don't realize what the Seahawks do, for example, on every Tuesday when they go out. You don't understand we want to see the D.A.R.E. program come back. Is this the kind of things that a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the athletes were already doing anyway in the community?
Yes, because, I mean, just like he said, you know, Tuesday is our day off in the NFL, so that's the day for guys to get out in the community and do things. The unfortunate part is that, you know, a guy's going to our local hospitals or meeting with kids or meeting with military families. Unfortunately, with the way things are in our society today, that's not what grabs that's not the headliner that grabs everybody's attention. So people don't hear about things like that as often, even though it's happening every week.
Exactly. And the fact is, you know, and Penn State was just down for the Tax Slayer Bowl a couple of years ago, so we saw the Jacksonville community firsthand. And it is a major Navy area. How important has that influence been in some of the decisions that have been made?
Very important. Very important. Because just like you said, the Navy, Marine Corps, we have Army bases here. Jacksonville is a very, very heavy military town, and we're very proud of that. And that's what a lot of guys were obviously concerned, because if guys were interested in making some sort of stand other than standing for the national anthem on Sundays, their main concern was they wanted our military personnel and local communities to know their message is nothing against the United States of America, our flag, or our United States military. We love them and appreciate and respect them to death. I mean, we have the opportunity to do this simply because of them. So that guys really tried to communicate that and take that into consideration.
Paul, you've got the New York Jets coming up, and you're going to go into the game with a record of 3-1. What kind of opportunity is this for Jacksonville right now?
Well, we're going in the game 2-1.
2-1.
The goal is to be 3-1 following this. But I mean, we view it as the chance. The last time, I can't tell you the last time Jacksonville was 3-1. That's what's so significant about this. We say, all right, this is a very, very good, talented New York Jets team. If we can play at the level that we're capable of, and be physical in the run game and do everything that we need to do to have success, then we have the opportunity to win and to get to 3-1. That's something that would, you know, this organization hasn't had in a long time.
Obviously, in a business, money is a factor. But what has kept you in Jacksonville all these years?
What has kept me in Jacksonville? Well, I love this organization. You know, when I came here as a free agent back in 2011, we've had some changeover from the general manager to, you know, multiple head coaching changes. But fortunately, I've had the opportunity to be under contract here and was able to play at a level or prove to new coaches coming in that I can be an asset to their team, and that I want to be a part of this team, and I want to be a part of this community. So that has been, I think that's had a big impact for me. It's just my desire to be here and to be a part of this group, because I've always felt like there's something special coming with this organization. It's just, we just have to continue to win and prove it and do all the things right on the field.
Paul, best of luck this weekend against the Jets. And again, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk with us today. A lot of Penn State fans have been anxious to hear you again. You gave them that opportunity today. We thank you.
It's always great talking with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Paul Posluszny of the Jacksonville Jaguars, the former Nittany Lion. We will come back, wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. High School Football Roundtable, followed by Spider Caldwell, followed by Paul Posluszny. Not a bad day again. Tomorrow, Lou Prado on the show. And we'll talk about a couple topics, including Fran Fischer being honored this weekend. Brandon is on our radio network. He is the godfather of it. And it's I mean, you know, I mean, Jerry and Jeff, his two sons, will be out there along with the rest of the family. It's great. It's just the part that hurts, though, Sean, is that, you know, you'd like to do these things when they're alive. It has nothing to do with the current administration. I mean, you know, he passed very quickly after they came in. You know, but, you know, you can't, like, maybe 10 years ago they should have been honored. That's just my opinion. I don't know what you think.
Last time I saw Fran was when the broadcast facility in Rec Hall was put in your name, in your honor, and always had a smile. Didn't matter who you were, what status you had, he treated you the same way. And just such a humble person.
Well, I mean, look, he set the tone. Now, I'm sure, I already know I'm going to talk about this at the beginning of the game. And I mean the beginning of the broadcast. I'm not going to, up in the booth's going to be a little bit different. But the beginning of the broadcast, I'm going to talk about that. Also, unbeknownst to him, I'm going to talk about Jack, too. I've already thought this out just a bit. But back in the 60s, when Penn State was really trying to kick football to another gear, the three critical people to make that happen were Joe Paterno, obviously, Jim Tarman, Fran Fischer. Each had their own roles in doing it. Fran going to so many Penn State clubs and so forth, trying to get everybody interested, excited about the product of Penn State football, going to, personally to each affiliate, trying to get as many radio stations on the Penn State Sports Network. Then himself delivering the broadcast, moving from the third role in the late 60s to then the play-by-play guy in 1970, and working with Mickey Bertstein, then extensively with Jim Tarman, then John Grant, then coming back in the late 90s with George Paterno, the 6 years they worked together. And you add in what he did with TV quarterbacks. He was the soundtrack of Penn State football. He was the soundtrack of Penn State football for decades. And he did it brilliantly. He did it passionately. He made the games exciting. He made the product sound really interesting that you wanted to come out and watch it for yourself. And he's going to be honored coming up on Saturday. I mean, what we have is a radio network. He laid all the groundwork for, from affiliates to style. And then, of course, you know, I'll talk a little bit more about Jack on Saturday. I'm not going to, you know, I won't. I want to talk about each guy, but I also at the same, you know, pay tribute to each guy. I also want to do it in an economical way because you do have a lot of fans that are sitting there that want to talk to Jack and Derek and get their thoughts on the game and the team and so forth. So, I mean, I want to be aware of that. But I think that'll be great because Jack's the honorary captain for the game. Beyond also being honored in conjunction with the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And for Fran's family, it's going to be a very emotional time. Of course, they lost Charlotte first, and then, you know, then Fran passed away 2.5 years ago. But for his sons, Jeff and Jerry, and the grandchildren and so forth, it's going to be a very emotional moment for them to be on the field and have the patriarch of the family recognized for all the legitimately great things he did for the university, fundraising, radio, TV, you name it. He was a pro's pro every step of the way in his career. Still had the ability to snap off the great one-liner and bring the house down right to the end.
Yeah, it didn't matter. It doesn't matter what Penn State fan you talk to, they will always say, they will always know that, you know, his love for Penn State was always there. I mean, it never wavered. Never, never wavered. That's never a question.
Blue band?
huge baseball fan. I've mentioned a couple times when he was 9 years old, his father brought him to Forbes Field to watch a game between the Pirates and the Boston Braves in 1935. And that was the day that Babe Ruth hit three home runs for the Braves, the last three home runs of his career. 7-12, 7-13, 7-14. Fran was at the game.
Penn State and Lock Haven wrestling before Penn State made it into the Big Ten. They were in the Eastern Wrestling League in the EWL. And there was a few, my first time I had a chance to meet Fran was, and that was when those very rare moments and occasions when Penn State would have to come to Lock Haven to wrestle in Thomas Fieldhouse. And there was one year where Fran was in one booth and the Lock Haven team was in the other booth, and I was walking down the hallway in between both doors and Fran popped out and had a chance to meet him. It was just a quick, you know, for me, that was a brush with greatness.
Oh, absolutely. He always did a lot for young broadcasters. Always did a lot for young broadcasters. When I was in college, he'd come on my college show back in the 70s. Always made the time to do it and made it easy for somebody like me, very easy. And I can't say enough great things about him. I will say more about him coming up on Saturday. You know, I'll do it in an encapsulated way. I mean, with all, you know, because there's still a lot of show to do, and a lot of fans will be there that want to talk to Jack and Derek about the game and about the team and so forth. So I want to be aware of that, but cannot start the broadcast without mentioning that, because we aren't sitting there without him. I mean, again, with Joe Paterno, Jim Tarman, I'll tell you, Jim Tarman's ability with the media to get the word out about Penn State, to get the word out about all potential All-American players, Jim was a master at that. You know, Jim's not talked about enough. Fran, obviously, has been talked about a lot, and justifiably, especially in my business. That's why I'm going to mention it coming up on Saturday. Joe, obviously, has always been mentioned. Jim is the one that doesn't get mentioned as often as the other two. And what Jim did with the media was brilliant, especially at a time where Penn State needed to get the word out, and you weren't on TV every week. In fact, you weren't on TV 9 out of 11 weeks. And Jim made sure that everybody found out who the great players were and how great Penn State football was. And so Jim's the one that doesn't quite get the just due at times that the other two do.
We are your home for the Philadelphia Phillies. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury.